I'd like to thank the organizers for the opportunity to speak. And like Julia, I've learned a lot of different things. I'm much more of a mathematician than I think most of the people in the audience. So I hope we can find some common ground. And also, I want to say, normally I talk about this from the perspective of non-locality, but I'm going to do my best to talk about it as a thing in contextuality. And hopefully I've done all my translations correctly, but I will hopefully try and sneak some stuff about non-locality in there as well. So like a lot of the other talks, the starting point for me when I think about contextuality is the Mermin-Paris square. And I don't even like to think about starting from observables. I just like to start from a set of equations. So we've got 9 variables filling up our box. We look at 3 equations corresponding to the rows and the columns, and we set all the rows equal to 0 and all the columns equal to 1. And then, as Julia put it very well, what we like to do to think of this as a physical scenario is imagine we're asking nature questions, and our questions are our equations, and then we get answers, which are the values in the equations. And we say that this equation is, this system of equations is contextual. And for me, that just boils down to the fact that this linear system has no solution. So if it did have a solution, we could imagine that nature would answer these questions by answering with the values of the solution, and then the equations would be always satisfied. But if we found a physical system where we could kind of ask about each equation in turn, and we found the values were always satisfied, but it doesn't have an equation, then we get into all the problems that you all are much more expert about than I am. But hence the word contextual. So the other thing that this system has and that makes it interesting, yeah?
Well, I just want to say this system can be solved in F3.
Yes, good question. So I forgot to mention, I was going to put this in. So linear system, 9 variables, and 6 constraints, and over Z2. Great. Yeah. Okay, so the other important part is that it's not just any old linear system, but it has a quantum model. And from the point of view that I'd like to take, this is just the same thing as a set of plus or minus 1 valued observables. X1 up to X9. And what do they satisfy? Well, they satisfy the equations. So for instance, X1, X2, X3 equals the identity. So notice I'm writing these as multiplicative equations, right? So if I have, instead of 0 and 1 for the values in my field, I have plus or minus 1. Right, then I should write my equations multiplicatively. So this is just x1 plus x2 plus x3 equals 0, same thing. So we have to check all 6 equations. The last one is x3, x6, x9, and being equal to 1 is the same thing as being with a minus identity. And the other thing about these is that any 2 of these observables commute if xi and xj belong to a common equation. So if you're used to starting with the observables for this scenario, you normally start with this box and you actually have explicit observables in here. Just take those observables and assign them to the appropriate variable, and what I'm saying is you get something that satisfies these 2 conditions. And the way to think about this is, for instance, that x1 and x2 commute, x3 and x9 would commute, for instance, they're in the same equation. But we have no reason to suspect that x1 and x9 would commute. They're not in the same equation or in a common equation. Okay. So what we want to do is generalize this. So suppose we have an M by N linear system of equations over Z2. And actually, most of what I say will generalize to other finite fields, but it's just a little simpler to talk about Z2. We'll say that the system is contextual. If this has no solution, and this is the most important definition, the system has a quantum model if there are plus or minus one valued observables, x1 up to xn, such that if we write the linear equations multiplicatively, they're all satisfied. And then the second part, which for me, and this might be a little naive, again, maybe it would be interesting to get the expert's opinion, but for me, the second part is really what makes this a quantum model and not just, say, a non-commutative operator solution or something like that. That's the fact that we have to have xj, xk equal to xk, xj if two variables lie in a common equation. Okay, so the basic question that I want to ask in this talk is, when does a linear system have a quantum model? And I take the point of view that if we have a good mathematical theory of contextuality or non-locality, we should be able to answer questions like this. And maybe the point of the talk is that it's more difficult to answer questions like this than you would think. And trying to come up with a mathematical theory of these things maybe gets us into deeper waters than we might have hoped for. But before I get into doing that, maybe the first thing to ask is, you know, asking whether one of these systems has a quantum model, is this a good question to ask? And maybe just, for instance, looking at it, the first thing we notice is we're missing something, which is the state from this picture. So I'm going to show you a few other different forms of this question that are equivalent. And both of which will have states in them. So the first one is this notion of contextuality that we heard yesterday from Mellon. So let me briefly remind you what that says. So in this point of view, we start with a hypergraph. I'm going to draw this as a blackboard bold H, because I'm going to inevitably start using H's for Hilbert spaces at some point. So remember, this is just a collection of vertices and edges. Edges are just subsets of the vertices, more or less. And this has a non-contextual model. If there is function p from vertices to either 0 or 1, such that when we sum over all vertices in the edge, we get 1. And this happens for all our edges. Okay, so H is contextual if it has no non-contextual model, and finally, H has a quantum model if there is a Hilbert space H. Is this visible from the top of the room down at the bottom of the board? Yeah, okay. And function, let's call this big P, from vertices to projections on H, such that the equivalent to this condition is satisfied, the sum over vertices in every edge of P of V is equal to the identity for all of our edges. Now again, this maybe still looks a little bit odd because we don't have any kind of we don't have any probabilistic model, and we still don't have any states in the picture. But the point is that H has a quantum model if and only if there is some assignment P of probabilities to every vertex such that P has a quantum model in this sense of yesterday's talk. Okay. And if you remember, this version involves states. So later on, for instance, if I say, you know, this hypergraph has no quantum model, in particular, it means that there's no way of putting any probability distribution on it which has a quantum model. Okay, so how does this relate to what we just defined in terms of linear systems? Well, this was first pointed out to me by Tobias Fritz. I don't know if anybody's ever really written it down, but it's not hard to see that given a linear system, there is a hypergraph H such that we have two things being the same. Okay, so one is that H is contextual if and only if the linear system is contextual. And second of all, H has a quantum model if and only if AX equals B has a quantum model. And one thing I haven't mentioned in the quantum model is the choice of Hilbert space. Actually, the Hilbert spaces are basically the same in both. In particular, whether you have a finite or infinite dimensional quantum model is the same on both sides. So how do we see this? It's not that hard, and I'll give you a brief sketch. I know some people are probably very familiar with these ideas already, but so let's say I started with three observables. X0, x1, and x2, such that x0, x1, x2 equals the identity. Oh, and I should mention, when I say observable, I'm always going to mean plus or minus one valued. In other words, self-adjoint, and they square to the identity. So, and x0, x1 equals x1, x0. X0, x2 equals x2, x0, and x1, x2 equals x2, x1. And in fact, I could have saved myself writing all this. That follows if you say what I just said about them being involutions from this equation. But OK, so how do I think about these observables as families of projections? Well, they represent joint measurements. So I could focus, for instance, on the first and second observable here. So x0, x1, and x2 corresponds to two projections, or sorry, four projections, really, I should say. Okay, so, but two-bit outcomes, that's the point. Okay, so p00, p01, p10, p11, they all have to sum to the identity, of course. And how does this correspondence work? Well, we think about x0 as being the observable for the first bit. So this would be equal here to p00 plus p01. That's a projection for getting 0 in the first bit, minus the projection for getting 1 in the first bit, 10 plus p11. Okay, and we would do x1 in the same way. P00 plus P10, 0 in the second bit, minus P01 plus P11. And then X2, the reason we only need four projections here is that we would have this being the XOR of the outcome. So P00 plus P11 minus P01 plus P11. Okay. In other words, given two projections, or four projections, sorry, if I define three observables in this way, they will commute and satisfy this equation. And vice versa, if I take the spectral projections, the joint spectral projections of the first two observables, I get back my four projections. So I can go back and forth between these two pictures. OK, so why? This basically solves the problem, but why? Well, in my hypergraph picture, I want to be able to talk about these four projections. And I also want to be able to talk about the spectral projections for each of these observables. Okay, so I have a problem of trying to address the sum of two projections in the hypergraph picture. Okay, so for this thing, I would make the following measurement labels. Zero, 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 one, one, zero, one, one. And then I would make measurement labels for each of the individual projectors. Zero, zero, plus zero, one. Zero, zero, plus one, zero. All the way on to the last one, zero, one, plus one, zero. So there are six of these. Okay, and then for contexts, I make one context which has got my 00, 01, 10, 11. I'm not going to draw the context overlapping because it never works out well for me, but I'm going to draw them separately and make the identifications. Okay, so another context is 00, 11. And then the last one would be 01 plus 10. That would be another example of a context I can add. And then I identify this one with this one, this one with this one, And that tells me that this, whatever the value of this projection would be in a quantum model, it would have to be the sum of these two projections, exactly like I want. So that allows me to address the sums of projections. So in total, I add another 6 contexts for every 1 context for every one of these additional measurement labels, in other words. That allows me to turn any linear equation into a hypergraph. So we get some blow up in the number of contexts, but we can do it in the end. Okay. Any questions about this so far?
So given a hypergraph, we can go backwards as well and find
them. I don't think so. I don't think from a general hypergraph you can go back to a linear system, but maybe some people would have some ideas about that. There are some things you can do that are more general than just linear systems, and maybe that you could go back and forth between. So, but all I'm claiming is that given a linear system, you can go to the hypergraph. I think that's seems more general. Yeah?
Just as a comment on that, I mean, we have to recall these things all versus nothing arguments. We know there are cases where you have all versus nothing arguments, but it's a strictly Sondre condition and being Sondre contextual, which is roughly what the hypergraph thing would be.
Yeah, you mean for all versus nothing being these specifically, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. But I wonder if from a hypergraph one couldn't go back to some more general form of game maybe here.
Even a hypergraph, you can extend the hypergraph, so eventually you end up with a hypergraph in which you can do that.
Oh, really? Okay, yeah. That's interesting. So maybe worth subject of discussion. Yeah. Okay, the other thing I want to talk about, let's see. Is the non-local game version of this. So I'm not going to say too much about it, just briefly. So given AX equals B, there is a non-local game G called the linear system game of the system such that, so there are kind of two things that relate quantum models for the linear system to the games, okay, so such that let's see, AX equals B has a finite dimensional quantum model if and only if G has a perfect, meaning a strategy, so let me see what it is, a perfect tensor product strategy. Okay, so perfect in this context means we can play with probability 1, success probability 1. And this is due to Cleave and Mattel. Okay, and the second thing we know here is that AX equals B has a quantum model if and only if G has a perfect commuting operator. Strategy. So all I want to say about that is that when we talk about non-locality, we have these two competing axiom systems for how we should represent two spatially separated systems. One is to take the tensor product of Hilbert spaces. The other is to look at one large Hilbert space and take the two commuting subalgebras of all operators on the full Hilbert space. And so we get kind of two different, potentially different situations depending on whether we're looking at tensor product strategies or commuting operator strategies here. Okay, so back to the main question that I mentioned before. When does AX equals B have a quantum model? So to answer this question, or try and answer it, we'll reformulate in terms of group theory. And if we look at the equations which I had on the board that I just erased, okay, the key thing is they almost look like group equations. They're just multiplication, you know, multiplicative formulas. But the only problem with them is there's a minus one in there. So we don't like to talk about minus one when we do groups. But other than that, we're really doing group theory when we look at those equations. So we fix that in a really silly way. So we look at the finitely presented group generated by x1 up to xn and one additional indeterminate, j, which will stand in for the minus 1. And so we have to make j behave like minus 1, which means we need to make it commute with everything. And we need it to square to the identity. And then after that, we just add in back all our other equations. We need that xi squared equals the identity. We need that the product over each linear equation is satisfied. We replace minus 1 with j now. And we need that xj and xk commute if these two things lie in a common equation. So putting all those conditions together, we get a finitely presented group, which I'm not sure it's the best name for it. But if we had a solution, if we had a classical linear system, we talk about the solution space. So this is kind of like solutions to the linear system. Let's call it the solution group. That's the argument for this term.
Just depend upon starting having a complex. So what if it were a real group in space?
Well, what I've done up to this point, pretty much nothing. Yeah.
The solution will differ?
Not at all, yeah.
Nice.
Because we can always decomplexify everything that we have here. I mean, basically all the results that I'm going to talk about won't be sensitive to complex versus real.
But the original, in the Merman case, it really did depend upon having it over the complex.
Sure, but C4 is R8. That's what I'm saying. Nothing of the conclusions that I'm going to draw depend on the difference between those two. Yeah. I'm not saying you couldn't draw a finer distinction. Yeah.
Capital AIJ is capital AIJ numbers?
yes. So we start with, we're given some linear system.
Yeah.
And then based on that, we are going to...
AJK is equal to identity in a group or something. Is this the last line?
Which one?
The next line. If
down here?
AIJ,
oh, yeah, thank you. Yep. Yeah. Good catch. Yeah. Yes, right. So that's all that's saying is if they're in the same equation, right, then they have to commute. Perfect. Well, we got another board. Yeah. Okay, so let me say some really trivial things. AX equals B has a quantum model if and only if J is non-trivial in a representation of gamma AB. So this is just a way for me to remind you, if you haven't seen it for a while, what a representation of a group is. Okay, we just look at our generators. We have to assign a matrix, or a unitary, really. on some Hilbert space to each one of the generators, and then make sure all the equations are satisfied for those things. So why do I get to say non-trivial here instead of j equal to minus 1? It's because it's a central element, so it commutes with everything. So if I did have it being non-trivial, I could just restrict to the minus 1 eigenspace. And then I would get one where it is actually equal to minus 1. Okay. Now, the nice thing about this is we've actually just done, I mean, it's really just tautological, but we actually have made some conceptual progress, because asking whether something is non-trivial in a representation is the same thing as asking whether it's non-trivial in the group. So this is if and only if J is not equal to the identity in gamma AB. And we can do the same thing here for, without this last step, finite dimensional quantum model if and only if J is non-trivial in finite dimensional representations of gamma AB. Okay, so we've recast our main problem as an instance of the word problem for a finitely presented group, right? So you might know the word problem. You start with some generators, you write down some relations, and the question is, given a word in the generators, is it trivial in the group? It's one of the famous examples of a problem that's undecidable. So looking at this, we might immediately say we've discovered something about, you know, how hard it is to figure out if this thing is a quantum model. But that's not necessarily true, because this is just an instance of the word problem. It doesn't mean that the fact that it's undecidable in general doesn't mean that it's undecidable on this type of group. So the question we really should ask next is, how complicated can the groups gamma AB actually be? Okay, and looking at this, if you just look at groups of this type, being generated by involutions, any group, like almost any group you write down, you change it a little bit, you can make it generated by involutions. It doesn't make things simpler. This equation, maybe it looks simple at first, it's just a linear, you know, it's a linear equation, but really, you know, it's a pretty general equation if the variables in there don't commute. So think of this as just being able to write down any old equation you want. The last one, though, looks really destructive. So we're saying we can write down pretty much any equation we want, but whenever we write down an equation, we have to make everything in it commute. So the example I'd like to do, my apologies to people who have seen it before, is just the example of S3, right? This is just a little toy example, but it really gets at the flavor of what happens when you start working with examples. So S3 is generated by two involutions satisfying this one equation. And what would happen if we wrote down this equation and then we had to say that, oh, that means that A and B commute. So if we mod out here by AB equals BA, right, this implies that AB cubed is just equal to AB, because we can bring the cube inside. So if we say that AB equals the identity, that's the same thing as saying A equals B. Right, so we would get, in the end, just Z2 if we had to do this with S3. So in general, we're writing down some group equations. We put these things on them. They're really destructive on the equations. So the question is, can these groups be complicated at all? And it turns out that despite this fact that it looks like maybe they're simpler, they're kind of simple groups, they can really be arbitrarily complicated. So given any finitely presented group, and even if we have, let's say, an element J in G, so J, a central involution. Okay, that means involution means it squares to the identity, and central means it commutes with everything. So then there is a linear system AX equals B. Such that there is an embedding, meaning an injective group homomorphism, okay, going from G into the solution group of the system, and such that our element J from G goes to the special element J inside of gamma. So now we can actually conclude it is undecidable to determine if AX equals B has a quantum model. Okay, so how does that work? Well, it turns out we do have to do a little bit more group theory, okay? It is undecidable to solve the word problem for central involutions. Okay, so we need to know that solving the word problem for central involutions isn't any easier than the general word problem, but it turns out this is pretty easy to get from to reduce from the general word problem, okay? And once we know it's hard for central involutions, this whole construction, it's constructive. So if you're given a finite presentation, you can actually write down explicitly what the linear system is, right? So if you had an algorithm for figuring out if this thing has a linear system, a quantum model, sorry. So you want to know if this thing has a quantum model. That's the same thing as figuring out if J is not equal to the identity in here. That's the same thing as solving the word problem, you know, figuring out whether J is non-trivial in gamma AB. But because this is an injection, that's the same thing as figuring out if J is trivial in there. So the injection's for the converse direction, right? So if we know that this thing is non-trivial, if we know this thing is trivial here, then it has to be trivial here. It couldn't just have been an artifact of the homomorphism. Okay, so the other thing we can do is following there are linear systems, AX equals B, which have infinite dimensional quantum models, but no finite dimensional quantum models. And I'd really like to do kind of the proof of this, but I think we just don't have time. When do we stop? 4:20?
We have like 15, 20 minutes for the rest of the talk and some questions.
Gotcha, okay. So maybe I'll sketch a little bit about the proof. So the part I want to tell you about is So the reason I would say that this is true is that basically there are groups with the same property. There are groups which have infinite dimensional models but no finite dimensional models. And so let me fill in what I mean by that specifically. So a group is non-residually finite if, so this is a group G, if there is an element in G which is non-trivial in the group as a whole, but such that if we look at any homomorphism to a finite dimensional representation, then we get the identity. Okay. So the key point is there are non-RF groups. And not only that, but I can write one down for you. For instance, I could take the following. So basically, I start with Z2, cross Z2. Okay, so two things which commute and square to the identity. And then I take a semi-direct product with Z by adding a generator Y, which basically flips the two generators. And then finally, X, Y, I take what's called an H and N extension. I add a partial automorphism which maps Y to its square. So as a result, what I get here is not a somewhat complicated, but not incredibly complicated group. In particular, the word problem for this is entirely solvable. Okay. So then the key idea, we'll kind of leave it up here, is that find G with the element J being our non-residually finite element. So J in the center of G, J squared equal to the identity, J not equal to the identity, and J non-residually finite. Okay, I don't want to take up too much more time, so the last thing I want to squeeze into the end of my talk here is, so this is all stuff from kind of last year, and I want to say some stuff about updates from over the previous year. So what can we do now that we couldn't a year ago? So one thing we've learned how to do is to handle the situation of finite models better. So far we've got undecidable to determine if there's a quantum model. But what if we only care about finite dimensional quantum models? Okay, so the key to handling something like this is the following theorem. So we need to update our embedding theorem here. So for some finitely presented groups, G, we can find G inside of one of these solution groups, such that if we have a finite dimensional representation here, what we'd like to be able to do is lift it to a representation of the solution group. And unfortunately, we haven't figured out how to do that at all yet. But what we can do is blow up the Hilbert space. And so we can find an embedding of this in some larger group, usually the depending on which version of this embedding I'm talking about, usually the dimension quadruples. And then we can find a representation of the larger group that kind of extends this original representation in this way. So what that means is, if I did have a quantum model, if I did start with a finite dimensional representation of some just some group here, I could extend it to a representation of this in a way that's an injection. So if we know that our J is non-trivial here, it will be non-trivial here. And that way we get a quantum model for the new group. So the kind of stuff we can do with that, so one is, it is undecidable. To determine if AX equals B has a finite dimensional quantum model. And it's very important that I mention for this that the proof does not just kind of follow in the same way. Well, we know that the word problem for groups is undecidable. Use some easy group theory here. But we need to use some more sophisticated group theory, and in particular, a family of groups called the Harlampovich groups. Including work by Harlampovich and Myasnikov and Sapir, which basically says we can get groups which, maybe a way to say it is that we can always get groups, we can get groups which have, are guaranteed to have, for non-trivial elements, finite dimensional representations that distinguish them. Those are the residually finite groups. But we can make the word problem arbitrarily difficult while doing so. If you know you always have a finite dimensional representation here, you know the word problem is solvable because you can look through finite models to find something that's not equal to the identity. But but aside from that constraint, right? So it has to be computable, but then pick any computable function you want and you can make the word problem arbitrarily difficult there. So the way this works is basically showing the same fact here, that the word problem for this is as hard as any computable function. Therefore, it can't be decidable. Kind of an interesting reduction. So some other things we can mention, I'll just list them. We can do with this updated theorem. It is undecidable to determine if AX equals B has finite dimensional almost models. What's an almost model? Same as a quantum model, but now the constraints have to hold only a norm up to some epsilon. So this would be if has finite dimensional almost model for all epsilon greater than zero. Okay, so this would be kind of like, maybe we don't have finite dimensional models, but maybe we have finite dimensional almost models for all epsilon. It's undecidable to determine if we have such a thing. And there are such models with what I just said. There are linear systems AX equals B with no finite dimensional quantum model. But with epsilon models, meaning in exactly the same sense as I used it up here, for all epsilon greater than 0, finite dimensional. Okay, so if you know something about these problems, you know that actually one of the most crucial problems we still face is there a gapped version of this? Is there some linear system which not only has no finite dimensional quantum models, but does not even have any epsilon models once you make epsilon small enough that are finite dimensional, but still has an infinite dimensional quantum model? That's a really famous problem. Nobody has anything about how to do that, you know, knows anything about how to do that. So that's the big thing that's still outstanding. Maybe the next best thing that we try to do in this picture is, what can we do to quantify this? So what would have to happen for such a game is, as we make epsilon smaller and smaller, the dimensions must be getting larger and larger here. So can we quantify how large the dimensions have to grow? Can we just have a system with finite number of equations and variables such that we make epsilon smaller and smaller and smaller, but we still have these almost models, but the dimension is growing and growing and growing? And so we have some preliminary results on that, like sublinear lower bounds. So the next practical question is, how fast can we make these dimension functions for how good a degree of approximation we have? How fast can we make them grow? So I'll stop there.
When you started with the first system, you derived the system from a graph, which is planar, right? Sometimes in graphical proofs of contextuality, you do planar graphs. So I wanted to know, how does the necessitability result relate to that?
So the Merman-Perry's?
Yeah.
When you mean by the first one? So I would actually say that if you look at the linear system for that, it's not planar.
Okay.
And it would be K33. So.
Okay, maybe.
There's a really great proof by Alex Arkhipov, which says that if you only look at linear systems which are every variable is in at most two equations, then you always can draw a graph associated with it, not a hypergraph, but an actual graph. I think it's actually dual. I mean, it's still a different picture from the hypergraph picture that we saw with contextuality, but it's also it's got vertices for equations. That's the key point, okay? And edges for variables. Okay, so if you draw that graph, then you have a quantum model. Assuming you're contextual, then you have a quantum model if and only if you are non-planar. Okay, so I'll repeat that because it came out kind of garbled. So if you have a linear system with every variable having at most being in at most two equations, and you are contextual, then you have a quantum model if and only if you're non-planar. So basically, quantum models reduce to the existence of a minor K33 or K5. It's a really great theorem by Alex Arkhipov.
Can you refine this to the undesirability to get every degree of unsolvability, which, you know, the original word problem has that feature, that you can get every degree of unsolvability?
So you mean in a sense of like recursion theory?
Yes.
Yeah, so those questions I usually say are over my pay grade, but basically, the only reductions I know how to do are the ones that come from the word problem. So if it's in the word problem,
right,
then it's then we have it.
You have
yeah.
These additional conditions. I'm not sure it all goes through. I mean,
that's a good question. Yeah.
One, you get every degree of unsolvability for different word problems. So it's not clear.
We can look through the reductions, but I have a feeling most of the reductions are actually quite elementary. So, yes,
so
everything should go through. Yeah. Yeah.
What's an epsilon model?
Yeah, good question. So that's a model where we So it's not a model in the same sense as I had before, but the only difference is rather than having the equations be exactly satisfied, they're satisfied within epsilon. That means you have to pick a norm, of course. So the canonical norm that matches up with what we like in the mathematical community is the normalized Hilbert-Schmidt norm. So 1 over square root of d, this norm, which would, depending if you're coming from the non-local, a non-local gain, this would be with respect to the maximally entangled state. So
what would be, so in what sense is it a solution to the linear system?
It's a solution to the linear system. If you imagine playing the game, then you're only going to, you're not going to see this thing be answered at, you know, perfectly every time. You're going to see some error rate, basically. Yeah. And you have to be a little careful about checking that. Almost none of this has been written down. But for non-locality, at least, for the non-local game version, that's definitely true.
So presumably when you construct these globals, they're not like the momentarized type of observables, right? They'll not have like this perfect compatibility sort of relations. Like that the product is exactly...
Oh, no, they should be... that's a good question. So should you require them to be perfectly compatible or not?
Because that's what it sounds like. They're not...
Agreed, yeah. So you want them... Yeah, so there's some subtlety in the definition. I think you can you should relax not almost perfectly compatible either. Like you should relax compatibility as well. But
I thought that was just the fact that you have all the observables in one equation. Compatibility is essentially that.
Yeah, so there might be some ways to fix it. I think to make it literally true as I've written here, you should say epsilon compatibility as well.
I'm just trying to make physical sense of what this thing means.
No, that's the perfect question. And if I had more time, I would give you the right answer here. But in the non-local game version, you can do what I say because you have kind of two players. And you can, in one, you don't have to worry about compatibility. And in the other, they kind of know the context. So then they can force things to be compatible. But I think to make what I said here literally true, you need almost compatibility as well. Yeah.
Perhaps, okay,
that's a good question. How does having finite dimensional epsilon models or all epsilon lead to having an infinite dimensional model? Is there any implication on the way?
Yeah, if you have them for all, then you have an infinite dimensional model as well. Yeah, you might need to be careful. You've got to say things in the right way, again. You want to make sure that you're not having something where, you know, it's fine in this context. So that's fine, yeah. If you do, that can get to be a very subtle question because if you're trying to set something not equal to the identity, and so you're asking whether something is, you know, not equal to the identity in all epsilon models, but then is it not equal to the identity in an infinite dimensional model? That's a subtle question. So you have to make sure you're always saying it's bounded away from whatever you choose. But aside from that, yep.
Okay, last question.
Maybe this is a very simple question. I'm just not thinking about it right. But what does this result mean for the kind of problem of characterizing the quantum set of correlations in contextuality scenarios? So a lot of people are focused on trying to describe the precise set of quantum correlations. does this result bear on that? Does it say?
I think the way you phrase your question kind of demands a precise answer, so maybe I better answer that offline. Because it probably should, right? But I'm not quite sure. So you know the non-local result, which is that you know, commuting operator correlations are different than tensor product correlations. So there should be something to say in the contextual scenario, but maybe we can figure it out offline would be the best way to do that, yeah.
Okay, so